Morning, Oregon, and happy Friday. I'm Finn J.D. John, FJ at offbeatoregon.com, and this is the Daily Offbeat Oregon History Podcast. Thanks for joining me, and I hope you enjoy the show today. This story was first published on July 15th of 2012 under the headline, Prison Break Happened During Conjugal Visit. Here we go. It was a few minutes after midnight on May 17, 1974, and the Oregon State Penitentiary employee sitting in his car outside the Salem Motel 6 was starting to get nervous. He was there to supervise a conjugal visit between a convicted cop killer named Carl Cletus Bowles and his fiancée, Joan Coberly, and the convict was supposed to have returned to the parking lot by midnight. He walked up to room 30, knocked on the door. No response. He went down and used the lobby telephone to call the room. No answer. Finally, the manager let him inside, and he found the room empty. Really empty. The bed hadn't even been sat on. The toilet still had the strip of paper over it that said, "Sanitized for your protection." Bowles and his fiancée were gone. Long gone. They had, it turned out, simply walked out the back door of the motel. It was a jailbreak. And it was quite possibly the most embarrassing jailbreak in United States history. Carl Cletus Bowles was a small, handsome man, charismatic, and before his prison days, something of a ladies' man. He'd gotten into trouble early, before he was a teenager even, and by his late teens he was doing hard time already for larceny. It was in July of 1965, on the run from the law after robbing a bank in Portland just a few days after his release from prison, that Bowles became a murderer. He and fellow bank robber Wilfred Marion Gray were speeding in a red 1958 Triumph TR3 on Delta Highway north of Eugene when 33-year-old Lane County Sheriff's Deputy Carlton Smith tried to pull them over for a speeding ticket. Bowles and Gray, after pulling the convertible over, turned in their seats and opened fire through the windshield of the cop car, shooting directly across the trunk lid of their sports car. Then they sped away, leaving Deputy Smith slumped in his patrol car with six pistol bullets and a charge of shotgun pellets in his body. Bowles and Gray led the cops on an extensive chase after that. They abandoned the Triumph, took a Eugene woman and her son hostage, forced them to drive them to Marion Forks, and released them there. Then they commandeered a camper truck, taking the family camping in it hostage, and forced them to drive to Sacramento. There they invaded the home of the finance director for the state of California, Hale Champion, took him, his wife, and their daughter hostage, and forced them to drive to Nevada. There they tried to rob a casino, and Champion was grazed by a bullet during the ensuing shootout before the robbers were taken into custody. It was primarily for the murder of Deputy Smith that Bowles was in prison at the time of his escape. Despite the gravity of this crime and the life sentence it had drawn, prison superintendent Hoyt Cupp knew that Bowles would eventually be released, probably at his next parole board hearing in 1982. So he was thinking about ways to encourage Bowles to reform himself so that when he was released he'd behave this time. To encourage this, Cupp thought a social pass, that is, a conjugal visit, would give Bowles a ray of hope and encourage him to rehabilitate himself. Bowles had been at some pains to charm Cupp, and it seemed his campaign had worked. Cupp had taken a personal interest in helping this seemingly compliant, positive prisoner to move beyond his sordid past. But now, it seemed, it had all been an elaborate con. Joan Coberly, it turned out, was actually Bowles' niece, not his girlfriend. She'd been making visits to the pen posing as his girlfriend, apparently for the express purpose of figuring out how to bust him out. This came as a surprise, but it shouldn't have. A teletype letter had come into the state pen 6 months earlier, just a few weeks after Coberly's first visit, from a detective in Amarillo, Texas, warning that Coberly was planning to break Bowles out. Cupp claimed he never saw the letter, and, well, maybe he didn't, although that would suggest a level of inattention to his duties that was hardly less damning than the alternative. As state and federal law enforcement agencies swung into action, the eyes of everyone were on Hoyt Cupp. What on earth had he been thinking, people wondered? Why was a man who was doing a life sentence for murdering a cop, who wasn't even eligible for parole for another 8 years, getting escorted to a motel room for sex? Wasn't that a bit irresponsible, given what often happens 9 months after such an encounter? Why didn't the prison authorities check to see if Motel 6 had more than one exit? And most of all, why was that teletype letter ignored? Governor Tom McCall, who had appointed Cupp and had great faith in him, docked his pay by $1,000 and suspended him for 2 weeks. Cupp offered his resignation, and McCall refused to accept it, but told him if anyone was hurt before Bowles was recaptured, that would probably change. That bluff would unfortunately be called. Twice. In the meantime, Bowles and Coberly were down in the hills near Eugene, hiding out. First camping, later in a commune, and after that on the property of a well-intentioned acquaintance. But authorities had tracked them down and they soon moved in. When FBI agents arrived, Bowles managed to get the drop on them. He shot at an FBI agent at point-blank range and missed, whether accidentally or on purpose, causing the agent to drop his pistol and scramble for cover. Bowles then fled the scene with the stolen gun. Then he went to the nearby home of Earl and Vi Hunter, took the couple hostage, and left town with them in their car. The felon then picked up where he'd left off the last time he was on the lam, taking hostages and hijacking cars and just wandering around the West, apparently with no idea what to do. Eventually, he wound up in the Spokane area, where officers soon found themselves responding to complaints of a man hijacking cars and motorcycles at gunpoint. They picked up his trail and chased him into the Spokane River, where, waist-deep in the water, he tried to get a shot off at a cop who already had him in his sights. The cop shot him in the stomach. Surgeons worked for hours to save Bowles' life, and were successful. And authorities badly wanted to talk to him. All the hostages he had taken were alive and accounted for, except for two. The Hunters, the couple he'd kidnapped in Eugene. What had happened to them? Bowles said he'd released them in Yakima. The cops knew, with a sense that people develop when they're lied to a lot, that he was lying. And of course, they found this very alarming. Finally, the bodies were found, about 20 miles south of Spokane in a rural area. It was now official. The penitentiary's carelessness had cost two innocent lives. In the months that followed, a number of voices called for Cupp's head to roll. However, Governor McCall decided not to fire him. He served as superintendent there for another 10 years before being promoted to a central admin position and retired in 1986. But Bowles' case had a significant impact on many Oregonians' views on crime and punishment issues, especially regarding the death penalty. If anyone deserved the death penalty, it was Carl Cletus Bowles, and they found it frustrating that the law wouldn't allow it to be applied. They also found it scary that a man like Bowles had been just a few years away from being paroled. And they felt that state prisons should be more focused on protecting innocent people outside its walls than rehabilitating those within. Even among folks who didn't agree with that assessment, there was a noticeable hardening of attitudes toward convicts just after this happened. Correlation does not necessarily imply causation, of course, but the correlation is most definitely there in this case. In a 1964 referendum, about 10 years before this murder, Oregonians overwhelmingly voted to abolish the death penalty. In 1978, a year or two after Carl Cletus Bowles was recaptured, they overwhelmingly changed their minds. This dramatic change was probably at least partly because of this case. One thing's for sure, conjugal visits got a lot more difficult to arrange in the years that followed. As for Bowles, he died in prison in 2005. Key sources in this episode included an episode of Doug Kent Crispin's Kick-Ass Oregon History Podcast, Oregon Jailbreaks, a book by Ann Rule titled Empty Promises, published in 2001, and back issues of the Bend Bulletin and Eugene Register Guard. That's our show for today. Thanks again for listening. And by the way, if you haven't yet, check out our Offbeat Oregon books. They're a lot like these columns, only expanded and updated to take advantage of a less restrictive format. We've got Heroes and Rascals of Old Oregon, Love, Sex, and Murder in Old Oregon, Bad Ideas and Horrible People in Old Oregon, and eventually the plan is for 8 of them to be out, although how many there are out right now depends on when you hear this. They're a lot of fun and would look great on your bookshelf. This podcast is part of Offbeat Oregon History, a public history resource for the state we love. Check out our hub page at offbeatoregon.com to explore all the other things we do or to find the full citations and visuals that go with today's show. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band and was written by Carmen Ficarra. Listen and download more at atlasstringband.com. Offbeat Oregon History episodes are uploaded every weekday morning at around 6 a.m., so it'll be a couple of days before you get your next fix. But of course, Monday morning will be here before we know it. And that's the latest news from here in Offbeat Oregon's Sulphur Springs studio. So now it's time for you and me both to go out there and fill up the rest of the day and the weekend with good stuff. Bye now.